In 2020, Sally Bolton took on the helm as CEO of Wimbledon, one of the world's most prestigious sporting events, and within weeks was engulfed by the COVID-19 pandemic and faced cancelling the championships. This show was recorded just before Christmas 2020, after a challenging year for any new CEO. We get a centre court, front row seat, listening to Sally explaining the leadership challenges and why the purpose driving Wimbledon will see the institution adapt and succeed through the coming years.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to The Evolving Leader. I'm Scott Allender, co-host of the show.
And I'm John Gomes. How are you feeling, Scott?
Well, as a tennis fan, I'm actually really thrilled to be talking to Sally Bolton today, the CEO of the All England Lawn Tennis Club, the organizer and historic home of Wimbledon. So how are you feeling, John?
Well, a real mix of gratitude to Sally for joining us, given everything that the club and the tournament's faced over the summer of the championships, and in the same vein, a real concern for the future of Wimbledon, given the disruption of COVID-19. I know Sally is an incredible leader, has done some amazing things in her career, and I can only begin to think about what she's been going through.
Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Sally, can we start by you walking us a little bit through your career and how you become the CEO of one of the world's top events, regardless of whether it's sports, and a cultural institution to boot?
Oh, I think I'd start by saying I'm still pinching myself because I can't quite believe that I have this role, as you say, leading one of the world's greatest sporting institutions, one of the world's greatest sporting events. It really is. It really is a kind of icing on the cake career-wise. So in terms of background, I've always worked in sport. It was always my passion. It's all I've ever done straight out of university, kind of, you know, first job, doing pretty much anything that anybody wanted doing at the Rugby Football League. And I just saw that as an opportunity to learn as much as I could about sport. And then from then, kind of various different roles, really, under the broad heading of sports administration, but quite a lot of that around major events. So a kind of quick journey through working at the Rugby Football League as the governing body, as events director, period of time as chief executive of Wigan Rugby League. And at the time when we purchased Oral Rugby Union and trying to integrate those two businesses, that was fascinating. Bit of time consulting with the Deloitte Sport Group and on my own with my own business consulting. And then latterly, before I joined the club, really focusing on delivery of major events. So I led the delivery of the Rugby League World Cup, which happened in 2013. Most successful Rugby League World Cup at that point in time of all time. And I went on from there to lead the local organising committee for the World Athletics Championships before arriving at Wimbledon in 2016, and done a couple of roles at Wimbledon before taking on the role of chief executive earlier this year. So, it's been a whirlwind ride. But my passion, I think, has always been the setting the stage for the actors, if you like, of sport. And so events have increasingly become my focus. So being the chief exec of the All England Club staging a fantastic event is just, as I say, I'm still pinching myself that I have the opportunity to lead such an amazing organisation.
And for our listeners, can you just explain a little bit about what the All England Club is? Because it's not necessarily what people might imagine. And a little bit about the governance and how it's structured, because it's an interesting leadership challenge from that perspective.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly unique in terms of the other Grand Slam. So it's the only Grand Slam that is run by a private members club. So the club itself was formed back in 1868, and back then it was formed as a croquet club, actually, originally, and it joined tennis to that as tennis became more fashionable, and 1877 was the year that it changed its name to the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club, and that was the first year that the championships were staged. So that history is really important, because a lot of what makes us very special, and the championship special, is that it is run by a tennis club. And it's a tennis club a lot like every other tennis club that you would recognise. We have members who are deeply passionate about the sport, love to play the sport, care passionately about the club, and take a real personal sense of ownership of the championship. So, as I say, so much of what we do and do well is based around the fact that our origins are as a tennis club. And so there's the club business. The championships business itself is is a not-for-profit business effectively. So we run the championships, and the surplus from running that championships goes, largely speaking, to the Lawn Tennis Association, which is the governing body for the sport in the UK, to invest in the development and performance of tennis. And then alongside that, we have a ground company, which owns the grounds on which we sit and on which the championships are staged. And then finally, we have the Wimbledon Foundation, which is the charitable foundation of the club and the championships. So it is a complicated governance mix, but a fascinating one, and so much history and heritage in where we've come from and why we are the way we are.
That is fascinating and quite a complex set of things to negotiate as a leader. But before we get into the detail, can you paint a little picture for our listeners to try and make them understand a little bit more about you in terms of what's your sweet spot at work look like? Where are you? What are you doing? What's exciting you? What makes a great day when you go home feeling really fulfilled?
Well, unsurprisingly, it's got to relate to the championships. And it's day one of the championships, and it's probably 6:37 in the morning, arriving at the grounds, hopefully the sun's shining, and the grounds are quiet, sort of frighteningly quiet, but there's a sort of quiet buzz. So there's a few people going about their job, so it might be some of the cleaning team finishing up their job, or some of the grounds team putting the finishing touches to the court. So there's this very quiet buzz, but it's very serene. But there's this real sense of anticipation, and this real sense of a bit of trepidation. At this point, you're feeling, you know, you've got a year's worth of effort invested in this, and you have no idea what's going to happen from this point on. And you're hoping it's going to go perfectly. You're a bit tired because it's been hard work in the build-up, but that's just real fantastic sense of being able to share with 500,000 people each year something you've worked so hard on and something you feel so passionate about. And just that period before we open the gates, it's just a really, really special time. And I think then the feeling of fulfillment at the end of the day is being out and around the grounds, and you see people leaving and the expressions on their face, and that just sense of having provided some really memorable moments for people, and that just feeling of shared joy is just irreplaceable for me. And that's the buzz from major events that I think you can't find in many other places.
So in a COVID world, obviously that's been incredibly disruptive for you and for that experience. Can you tell us a little bit about what your agenda was, you know, coming into this versus what your agenda's had to shift from a leadership perspective in a COVID world?
So in some respects, the agenda hasn't shifted. I think there's just been a slightly different focus. So my agenda coming into the role really centers around three areas of our emerging strategy. One of those is focusing on maintaining the championships at the pinnacle of the sport. The second one is, and it sounds obvious, but it's important, is caring about tennis. It's where we come from. It's who we are. And the third part of that is using our resources and influence to be a force for good. Those three things are absolutely central to what I wanted to achieve when I took the role back in December, when the world was a different place. And that didn't really change through the period of deciding to cancel the championships and then the way in which we acted beyond that point. In some respects, it was just different things came to the fore. So it was obvious to us, having made the difficult decision to cancel the championships, that our first priority was then to think about how we could help and support our local community. Because at our heart, our local community matters to us. Where we live matters to us. So really strong pivot to lots of effort and energy on Force for Good. So whether it was putting together a £1.2 million coronavirus fund through our foundation, or opening up one of our kitchens to cook 200 hot meals a day for people in need around the borough, redistributing the thousands of towels we'd ordered for the championships that we then weren't going to need. It was obvious what we should do because we were clear about what the priorities were. So there was just a slightly different spin on it. And I think the only other thing that has felt very significant from a leadership standpoint has been communication. I've talked about this endlessly with other leaders, and the universal view is you cannot communicate enough. So whether that's colleagues internally, your board, or whether that's our suppliers, our partners, our players, our officials. It was just enormous amounts of effort, and continues to be the case, actually, being invested in just talking to people and sharing what you know, not always having the answer, but communicating as much as you possibly can, and then probably some more.
So that's really interesting to hear that you had a kind of set of North Star metrics that you could just co-opt into a completely different situation. But, you know, this is the first time since 1877, outside of the World Wars, where you didn't have Wimbledon, the championships. The other Grand Slams, I understand, did. So how hard was it to make that decision?
It was a really very difficult and very painful decision for us to make, but absolutely the right decision. And despite the changing circumstances over the summer, beyond the point we'd made the decision, it was still very clear that it was the right decision to make. And just sort of thinking about, thinking about the comparison with some of the other Grand Slams, one of the things that we have that's unique to us, of course, is playing on grass. And because of playing on that natural surface, the window of time in which you can play is much smaller. So for example, moving our championships to further back in the year just simply isn't possible because of the surface. So the window is really small. So that was never really a consideration for us. And I think the other thing, clearly front of mind in all of our decision making, was the health and safety of our colleagues, of our members, of our contractors. And we start building, both physically and metaphorically, the championships from about April time. So although the championships don't happen until June, actually the volumes of people we needed on site doing things was significant from April. And so it just wasn't possible to be able to do those things in the conditions that we found ourselves in. And then the final consideration we made was the responsibility we had not to try to stage an event that does draw medical resources and other resources from the community where those resources were better needed. That was another important part of our consideration. So it was a difficult decision, but in the end it was the right decision, and we have not regretted it since then. And actually it gave us an opportunity to do some different things. And I suppose once we'd made the decision, it probably took us 2 or 3 weeks to sort of emotionally recover as an organization from making that decision. And then we got focused on, well, what are we going to do with the time we've got? You know, how can we positively use the time that we wouldn't ordinarily have?
So, Sally, I'm fascinated by the leadership challenges of running an organization that seems to have so consistently managed to balance being a fundamental national and global source of tradition while being very innovative. What does that involve? And can you paint a picture for the innovation of the future, like where you're taking this thing?
It is a constant challenge, the balance of heritage with innovation. And it's something we think about very purposefully and we talk about an awful lot. And perhaps at the heart of that is really understanding what is tradition and truly relevant and pertinent to our heritage, and what is just a historical way of doing things. And because people get very, very wedded to the way in which they've done things, those debates get quite heated sometimes, actually. I think historically we have plotted our way through that really very well. I think perhaps most recently one of the best examples of that was the way in which we've taken our ticket ballot online. True tradition is the maintenance of a ballot. That is the fairest way to distribute tickets for the championships. And being true to our values, a fair distribution is the tradition. That's the priority. The way in which the ballot ran previously was felt to be a tradition, but it was not in line with delivering the best service to our guests. And so we maintained the core tradition, which is the ballot, but we made sure that in terms of delivering it, it was a much more modern, much more in line with what our customers want, actually. And so it was a good example of that challenge of where is the real tradition and where is just the habit of doing things in the way that you've always done them. And it's frightening for people to change significantly. And so there's always a decent amount of work persuading people that change is right, and then supporting them through that change. And the ticket ballot is a great example. And we've got an awful lot more to do in that ticketing space in terms of modernising. I suppose the other part of it is focusing less on the vehicle and focusing most on what it is your guests want. So one of the things that we have started to invest more time and energy in the last couple of years is better understanding our guests, getting greater guest insight, and starting to think purposefully about their guest journeys and where we can make an impact on those guest journeys positively. And so rather than thinking about, you know, the framework is social media and how we're going to use that, actually the start point is, what is it we are trying to achieve? How are we trying to improve our guest journey, and how can we use all of the different tools that are available to do that? And so that's how we've tried to maintain this sense of being innovative, but doing it in a very Wimbledon way.
So I want to pick up on that question a little bit more and dig into it from the perspective of, how do you manage that competing demand of short-term performance? You've got to deliver this amazing experience every year, and you've got to deliver, frankly, quite a lot of money that you're paying into the LTA, with growth, long-term growth, preservation of the heritage into the future, and innovation around it. And particularly as you embark in something that's as significant as that huge new project, the master plan, which means expanding into your site's footprint, which I'd like you to tell us a little bit about as well. But how do you manage that balance between today and tomorrow?
You have to concentrate very hard on it. So what we have in a somewhat legendary way been very good at doing is focusing on the detail, this idea of the list, which is all of the things from each championship that we're going to do better next year. So we have an absolute pursuit of excellence that is never ending. We never believe we've got it right. And culturally, that's challenging, but it's also a great culture. There's a real sense of wanting to be better every time. But what that often generates is a sort of annual iterative version of being a bit better than last year, which has been incredibly successful. And that, coupled with our attention to detail, is a significant part of our success. But of course, if you haven't plotted out where you want to end up, it's hard to understand whether the things you're going to do next year are going to contribute to that or not. So balancing the two is an important challenge. One of the other things that we have historically been very good at is planning for the very long term. We have always thought very long term, and the master plan is probably one of the best examples of that. So when we start to think about developing that out, we're talking about envisaging what the championships will look like in 25 years from now or 30 years from now, not what they're going to look like in 5 years from now. So just to give you a bit of background to the master plan, we acquired the golf course, which is adjacent to our current site, back at the end of 2018. And that significantly increases the size of our site. Is a fantastic Grade 2 star listed Capability Brown landscape. It's currently a golf course. So we are embarking on a piece of work to develop a master plan for the whole site with two focuses in mind, really. One is maintaining the championships at the pinnacle of the sport. So how can we make the championships even better over time with more space? And the second part is how we can use that additional land to give something back to our local community particularly. So that master plan is very much in development. It's early days. When you have such an amazing opportunity, it presents a compelling challenge for all of the things you could do versus getting down to, well, so what are we going to do? And interestingly, one of the winners from the cancellation of the championships has been the master plan, because for the period this year when a lot of our very talented, knowledgeable and experienced championships deliverers would have been busy, actually they've been available. And so there's been an awful lot of time invested in shaping and thinking about the championships of the future based on what we know now. So, and it's also provided a really positive focus for a lot of colleagues who otherwise have had the thing they normally are focused on taken away. So we the short term versus long term dynamic is something that's very much front of mind at the moment.
We want to hear from you. Send us your leadership questions on Instagram at evolvingleader, and John and Scott will address them in a future show. And be sure you're subscribed to the Evolving Leader podcast on your favorite platforms so you catch all of our exciting new content. Thank you for listening. Now, let's get back to the show.
So tennis has had a long track record in attracting headlines around diversity issues. I'm thinking about Billie Jean King's fight for equality and prize money, for example. What are some of the leadership challenges and some of the biggest opportunities in being something of a lightning rod for some of these biggest issues facing us today in the Me Too space, equity, inclusion, diversity, et cetera?
I think one of the biggest challenges for all organizations is the pace of social change and how quickly things can change. You know, so for an organization that stages one event a year, so has one window a year, you know, we have to make sure that we are keeping pace with that change. There is very clearly a significant shift in the level and type of expectation that society places on organizations around having a positive impact on society. It's no longer good enough to be a producer of amazing products or deliver of amazing services. There is a greater expectation that you are more than that. You stand for more than that. When I think about the history of our organization and our values and the culture of the All England Club, in some respects, it's a fantastic opportunity because it's so much in the sweet spot of who we are and what we stand for. But as I say, with the pace of social change, the risk of being caught out, I think, is high for lots of organizations. I think sport has a perhaps a unique, but certainly a very significant opportunity to influence and make change, perhaps more than most other environments. And so it's a responsibility we all need to take seriously because, as we often say, when the All England Club has a view about something, that gets reported, it gets talked about. So we need to be very careful that we're being authentic about it. And so we've talked a lot in the last 6 to 9 months about actions speaking louder than words. And if we are going to stand for something, we need to make sure that we are doing things well ourselves before we start talking about that more broadly. And so certainly my focus is on making sure that we are able to advocate for particular things based on us doing a good job. And we've got plenty more work to do in that space. But I think it presents a really fantastic opportunity, as I say, in terms of our value set and going back to those kind of three areas of focus for the organization. Being a force for good is really integral to what it is we want to achieve.
So if you look back, Sally, over the last year, you've been really tested as a leader, you know, taking on this huge job. You're the first woman to take this job on, although from what I know of Wimbledon, that's a kind of non-issue. But what do you think you've really learned about yourself through this process?
What I've learned really clearly, and I knew it before, but I think it's just underlined it, that the values of the organisation I work for being aligned to my values matters deeply in terms of me getting out of bed in the morning and feeling good about what I do for a living. And, you know, what you do for a living takes up a lot of your time. And so I think I knew it before, but I think it's just underlined to me that in choosing to work somewhere, and particularly in my case, choosing to leave somewhere, having that alignment of values is just so critical.
What do you do to invest in yourself and take care of yourself, the pace that you have to run every day?
Well, the answer is not enough. And so it's the constant reminder of, you know, the way you take care of your colleagues and your team is you make sure you take care of yourself. But that's something I definitely have to remind myself regularly about. I focus a lot on the work-life balance. And on, you know, particularly working from home now, I think for lots of us, it's very, very easy for all of it to merge together and merge together in a bad way, which just means work is all pervasive and everywhere. And so I have a space I work and the door is shut to the space I work when I've finished work. And I try very hard not to be picking up my phone all weekend. I think I keep learning. I think as I've got older and taken more senior roles, I think I've focus more on what more I can learn, certainly more than I did when I was first starting out in my career. It feels like it's much more of a focus. I'm finding time to do that. And just finding time to do things that force you to switch off. So I learned to fly fish lots of years ago now. And it's an odd one. But the reason why fly fishing works for me is because you have to concentrate on what you're doing, and it consumes your entire brain. It's impossible for your brain to worry about other things when you're fly fishing. And so that's that kind of active relaxation that that I have to have, because otherwise the brain's whirring around.
What inspires you the most?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think what inspires me, and I sort of talked about it before, is that sense of delivering something special that creates so much joy and excitement for so many people as a shared experience. That the feeling of being able to set the stage for that really inspires me.
The way you described that earlier, I felt like I was there with you, ready for the doors to open.
Well, I've been there on those days that Sally's talking about, it, and it does have, there is an atmosphere and a feeling associated with the place, which I've never experienced anywhere else. I don't know what that, why that is. You know, you can put it down, but it definitely is palpable.
Yeah, and I don't know either quite. You know, it's that classic, if that's the secret sauce, what's the recipe? And trying to bottle that is tough, because it's a real alchemy of lots of different things coming together. I mean, the weather matters, and that's something we can't control.
So what was the most surprising thing for you when you stepped into the role, when you joined the organization? Because you had a precursor job first. What was most surprising about joining Wimbledon?
Well, I think I hadn't had any experience running tennis events. So I think the thing that intellectually was quite challenging was that a tennis event is lots of mini events going on at the same time. So although you're entering one grounds, you know, you've got 18, once you start play on those courts, you've got 18 mini venues all in the same venue, and they're all running at a different pace. And once a tennis match starts, you don't know when it's going to end. So there's this total lack of any certainty once you open the gates, but for when the gates will close, or indeed what will happen in that day. And that, you know, as an event deliverer, that kind of intellectual challenge of trying to get used to that, you know, coming from athletics or from rugby league, where, you know, the event starts, those things happen, and then people leave, and it's pretty clear about what will happen in the middle. It's like the grounds is like a sort of mini city during the championships. There's lots of different things going on in different places. And so that was a big shift, but a really enjoyable kind of intellectual challenge to get your head around how that works and how all the pieces fit together.
And as you think about the next decade and the acceleration of social media and new technologies, augmented reality, everything that you can think of, how's that going to change the experience of Wimbledon and the challenges from your perspective as a leader?
What I hope doesn't change is the specialness of being at a sporting event live. So for all the other ways that you might be able to experience it, I hope that the golden ticket of being able to come to the championships and sit on centre court and experience it live, I hope that never goes away, because to me that is something really special. Of course, there is the potential that in the future you will be able to almost feel exactly that, or maybe even feel that. And it fascinates me what that will look like. I think one of the challenges we've got to stay very live to is making sure that the experience live is as rewarding and as full of information, if you like, as watching sport at home. And I think one of the challenges for sport is sometimes that the kind of the experience you have watching from your sofa, you don't get the atmosphere as such, but actually can be more rewarding, more informed, more interesting than the live experience. And I think that is something we've got to think very carefully about. But that's a great challenge, actually. You know, those opportunities are there.
So obviously this has been a particularly trying and challenging season for leaders everywhere, stretching all of us in ways that we hadn't predicted. We talked a little bit about some of those ways throughout the show. But what is a piece of practical advice that you would give to the evolving leader who is listening to you right now?
I think, and particularly this has been brought home to me in the last 6 months or so, but I think just don't be afraid to be vulnerable. Don't be afraid to be open. Don't be afraid to admit that you don't have all the answers, because it is amazing. It is amazing what doing, what kind of a response can be elicited from doing that from your team. In some respects, it's been forced on many of us because we don't know the answer. None of us do to a lot of the situation we find ourselves in. But actually, I think what I felt is just the power of doing that. Maybe more so actually in a crisis. I think people even more so appreciate the sense of you being a human like them and feeling uncomfortable with the situation and a bit afraid. I think people really relate to that. So I would say, Don't be afraid to be vulnerable. I think it's quite a hard thing to do for a lot of people. I think I feel more comfortable now. I'm older and more experienced. If you'd have suggested to me that being vulnerable was a good thing to do when I was 25, I don't think I could have done it. So I would say if you're building through your career, it's something you should be thinking about.
I love that.
Excellent. Well, Sally, thank you so much. This has been really fun talking to you, as always.
Yes, thank you, Sally.
You're really welcome. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Until next time, the world is evolving. Are you?